Time Warner Audiobooks presents The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference, written by Malcolm Gladwell and read by the author.
For hush puppies, the classic American brush suede shoes with the lightweight crepe sole, The Tipping Point came somewhere between late 1994 and early 1995. The brand had been all but dead until that point. Sales were down to 30,000 pairs a year, mostly to backwoods outlets and small-town family stores. Wolverine, the company that makes hush puppies, was thinking of phasing out the shoes that made them famous. But then something strange happened. Two hush puppy executives, Owen Baxter and Jeffrey Lewis, ran into a stylist from New York at a fashion shoot who told them that the classic hush puppies had suddenly become hip in the clubs and bars of downtown Manhattan. "We were being told," Baxter recalls, "that there were resale shops in the village, in Soho, where the shoes were being sold. People were going to the Ma and Pa stores, the little stores that still carried them, and buying them up." Baxter and Lewis were baffled at first. It made no sense to them that shoes that were so obviously out of fashion could make a comeback. "We were being told that Isaac Mizrahi was wearing the shoes for his personal use," Lewis says. "At the time, we had no idea who Isaac Mizrahi was." By the fall of that year, things began to happen in a rush. First, the designer John Bartlett called. He wanted to use hush puppies in his spring collection. Then another Manhattan designer, Anna Sui, called, wanting shoes for her show as well. In Los Angeles, the designer Joel Fitzgerald put a 25-foot inflatable basset hound, the symbol of the hush puppies brand, on the roof of his Hollywood boutique and gutted an adjoining art gallery to turn it into a hush puppies department store. It was total word of mouth, Fitzgerald remembers. In 1995, the company sold 430,000 of the classic hush puppies. The next year, it sold four times that. And the year after that, still more, until hush puppies were once again a staple of the wardrobe of the young American male. Hush puppies had suddenly exploded, and it all started with a handful of kids in the East Village in Soho. Those first few kids, whoever they were, weren't deliberately trying to promote hush puppies. They were wearing them precisely because no one else would wear them. Then it spread to two fashion designers who used the shoes to peddle something else, haute couture fashion. The shoes were an incidental touch. And then, in the space of a year, boom, the shoes exploded. They went past a certain point and they tipped. How did that happen? How does a $30 pair of shoes go from a handful of downtown Manhattan hipsters and designers to every mall in America in the space of 2 years? There was a time, not very long ago, in the desperately poor New York City neighborhoods of Brownsville and East New York, when the streets would turn into ghost towns at dusk. Ordinary working people wouldn't walk on the sidewalks. Children wouldn't ride their bicycles on the streets. The drug trade ran so rampant, and gang warfare was so ubiquitous in that part of Brooklyn, that most people would take to the safety of their apartments. In 1992, there were 2,154 murders in New York City, and 626,182 serious crimes, with the weight of those crimes falling hardest in places like Brownsville and East New York. But then something strange happened. At some mysterious and critical point, the crime rate began to turn. It tipped. Within 5 years, murders had dropped 64.3% to 770, and total crimes had fallen by almost a half to 355,000. In Brownsville and East New York, the sidewalks filled up again, and the bicycles came back. The New York City police will tell you that what happened in New York was that the city's policing strategies dramatically improved. Criminologists point to the decline of the crack trade and the aging of the population. Economists, meanwhile, say that the gradual improvement in the city's economy over the course of the 1990s had the effect of employing those who might otherwise have become criminals. But the demographic changes are all long-term trends happening all over the country. They don't explain why crime plunged in New York City so much more than in other cities around the country. And they don't explain why it all happened in such an extraordinarily short time. How can a change in a handful of economic and social indices cause murder rates to fall by two-thirds in 5 years? The Tipping Point is the biography of an idea, and the idea is very simple. Ideas and products and messages and behaviors spread just like viruses do. The rise of hush puppies and the fall of New York's crime rate are textbook examples of epidemics in action. Although they may sound like they don't have very much in common, they share a basic underlying pattern. First of all, they are clear examples of contagious behavior. No one took an advertisement out and told people that the traditional hush puppies were cool and they could start wearing them again, Those kids simply wore the shoes when they went to clubs or cafes or simply walked the streets of downtown New York. And in so doing, they exposed other people to their fashion sense. They infected them with the hush puppy virus. The crime decline in New York surely happened the same way. It wasn't that some huge percentage of would-be murderers suddenly sat up in 1993 and decided not to commit any more crimes. Nor was it that the police managed to magically intervene in a huge percentage of situations that would otherwise have turned deadly. What happened is that the small number of people in the small number of situations in which the police or the new social forces had some impact clearly started behaving very differently. And that behavior somehow spread to other would-be criminals in similar situations. Somehow, an awful lot of people in New York got infected with an anti-crime virus in a short time. The second distinguishing characteristic of these two examples is that in both cases, little changes had big effects. All of the possible reasons for why New York's crime rate dropped are changes that happened at the margin. The crack trade leveled off, the population got a little older, the police force got a little better, yet the effect was dramatic. So too with hush puppies. How many kids are we talking about who began wearing their shoes in Manhattan? 20? 50? 100 at the most? Yet their actions seem to have single-handedly started an international fashion trend. Finally, both changes happened in a hurry. They didn't build slowly and steadily. Crime didn't taper off. It didn't gently decelerate. Rather, it hit a certain point and jammed on the brakes. These three characteristics, contagiousness, the fact that little changes can have big effects, and that change happens not gradually but at one dramatic moment, are the same three principles that define how measles move through a grade school classroom or how the flu attacks every winter. Of the three, the third epidemic trait, the idea that epidemics can rise or fall in one dramatic moment, is the most important because it is the principle that makes sense of the first two and that permits the greatest insight into why modern change happens the way it does. The name given to that one dramatic moment in an epidemic, when everything can change all at once, is the tipping point. A world that follows the rules of epidemics is a very different place from the world we think we live in now. Think for a moment about the concept of contagiousness. If I say that word to you, you think of colds and the flu or perhaps something very dangerous like HIV or Ebola. We have in our minds a very specific biological notion of what contagiousness means. But if there can be epidemics of crime or epidemics of fashion, there must be all kinds of things just as contagious as viruses. Have you ever thought about yawning, for instance? Yawning is a surprisingly powerful act. Just by listening to the word yawn in the previous sentences, a good number of you will probably yawn within the next few minutes. If you're listening to this in a public place and you've just yawned, chances are that a good proportion of everyone who saw you yawn is now yawning too. And a good proportion of the people watching the people who watched you yawn are now yawning as well, and on in an ever-widening yawning circle. Yawning is incredibly contagious. I made some of you listening to this yawn simply by saying the word yawn. The people who yawned when they saw you yawn, meanwhile, were infected by the sight of you yawning, which is a second kind of contagion. They might even have yawned if they'd only heard you yawn, because yawning is also orally contagious. If you play an audio tape of a yawn to blind people, they'll yawn too. And finally, if you yawned as you heard this, did the thought cross your mind, however unconsciously or fleetingly, that you might be tired? I suspect that for some of you it did, which means that yawns can also be emotionally contagious. Simply by saying the word, I can plant a feeling in your mind. Can the flu virus do that? Contagiousness, in other words, is an unexpected property of all kinds of things, and we have to remember that if we are to recognize and diagnose epidemic change. The second of the principles of epidemics, that little changes can somehow have big effects, is also a fairly radical notion. We are, as humans, heavily socialized to make a kind of rough approximation between cause and effect. If we want to communicate a strong emotion, if we want to convince someone that, say, we love them, we recognize that we need to speak passionately and forthrightly. If we want to break bad news to someone, we lower our voices and choose our words carefully. We are trained to think that what goes into any transaction or relationship or system must be directly related in intensity and dimension to what comes out. Consider, for example, the following puzzle. I give you a large piece of paper, 1/100th of an inch thick. That's a typical thickness. I want you to fold it over once and then take the folded paper and fold it over again, and then again and again until you've refolded the original paper 50 times. how tall do you think the final stack is going to be? If you ask people that question, they'll fold the sheets in their mind's eye and usually answer that the pile would be as thick as a phone book. Or, if they're really courageous, they'll say that it would be as tall as a refrigerator. But the real answer is that the height of the stack would approximate the distance to the sun. And if you folded it over one more time, the stack would be as high as the distance to the sun and back. This is an example of what in mathematics is called a geometric progression. Epidemics are another example of geometric progression. When a virus spreads through a population, it doubles and doubles again until it has figuratively grown from a single sheet of paper all the way to the sun in 50 steps. As human beings, we have a hard time with this kind of progression because the end result seems far out of proportion with the cause. To appreciate the power of tipping points, we have to abandon this expectation about proportionality. We need to prepare ourselves for the possibility that sometimes big changes happen very quickly. Then there is the idea of the tipping point itself, which might be the hardest of all to accept. The phrase the tipping point first came into popular use in the 1950s and 1960s to describe the flight to the suburbs of whites living in the older cities of the American Northeast. When the number of incoming African Americans in a particular neighborhood reached a certain point, 5% or 7% or 10%, sociologists observed that the community would tip, meaning that almost all the remaining whites would leave almost immediately. There was a tipping point for violent crime in New York City in the early 1990s, and a tipping point for the reemergence of hush puppies. All epidemics have a tipping point. Jonathan Crane, a sociologist at the University of Illinois, has looked at the effect the number of role models in a community, the professionals, managers, teachers, whom the Census Bureau has defined as high status, has on the lives of teenagers in the same neighborhood. He found little difference in pregnancy rates or school dropout rates in neighborhoods of between 5 and 40% of high status workers. But when the number of professionals dropped below 5%, the problems exploded. For black school children, for example, as the percentage of high-status workers falls just 2.2 percentage points, from 5.6% to 3.4%, dropout rates more than double. At the same tipping point, the rates of childbearing for teenage girls, which barely move up to that point, nearly double. We assume, intuitively, that neighborhoods and social problems decline in some steady progression, but sometimes they may not decline steadily at all. At the tipping point, schools can lose control of their students, and family life can disintegrate all at once. I remember once as a child when I saw my family's puppy encounter snow for the first time. He was shocked and delighted and overwhelmed, wagging his tail nervously, sniffing about in the strange, fluffy substance, whimpering with the mystery of it all. It wasn't that much colder on the morning of his first snowfall as it had been on the evening before. It might have been 34 degrees the previous night, and now it was 31 degrees. Almost nothing had changed. Yet everything had changed. Rain had become something entirely different. Snow. The world of the tipping point is a place where the unexpected must be expected, where radical change is more than a possibility. It is a certainty. In the mid-1990s, the city of Baltimore was attacked by an epidemic of syphilis. In the space of a year, from 1995 to 1996, the number of children born with the disease increased by 500%. If you look at Baltimore's syphilis rates on a graph, the line runs straight for years, and then, when it hits 1995, rises almost at a right angle. What caused Baltimore's syphilis problem to tip? According to the Centers for Disease Control, the problem was crack cocaine. Crack is known to cause a dramatic increase in the kind of risky sexual behavior that leads to the spread of things like HIV and syphilis. It brings far more people into poor areas to buy drugs, which then increases the likelihood of them taking an infection home with them to their own neighborhood. It changes the patterns of social connections between neighborhoods. Crack, the CDC said, was the little push that the syphilis problem needed to turn into a raging epidemic. John Zellman, a sexually transmitted disease expert at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, has another explanation: the breakdown of medical services in the city's poorest neighborhoods. In 1990-91, we had 36,000 patient visits at the city's clinics, Zellman says. Then the city decided to gradually cut back because of budgetary problems. The number of clinicians went from 17 to 10. The number of physicians went from 3 to essentially nobody. Patient visits dropped to 21,000. There was also a similar drop in the amount of field outreach staff. When there were 36,000 patient visits a year in the STD clinics of Baltimore's inner city, in other words, the disease was kept in an equilibrium. At some point between 36,000 and 21,000 patient visits a year, the disease erupted. Suddenly, people who may have been infectious for a week before getting treated were now going around infecting others for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks before they got cured. The breakdown in treatment made syphilis a much bigger issue than it had been before. There is a third theory which belongs to John Potterat, one of the country's leading epidemiologists. His culprits are the physical changes in those years affecting East and West Baltimore, the heavily depressed neighborhoods on either side of Baltimore's downtown, where the syphilis problem was centered. In the mid-1990s, he points out, the city of Baltimore embarked on a highly publicized policy of dynamiting the old 1960s-style public housing high-rises in East and West Baltimore. Two of the most publicized demolitions, Lexington Terrace in West Baltimore and Lafayette Courts in East Baltimore, were huge projects housing hundreds of families that served as centers for crime and infectious disease. At the same time, people began to move out of the old row houses in East and West Baltimore, as those began to deteriorate as well. It was absolutely striking, Potterat says, of the first time he toured East and West Baltimore. 50% of the row houses were boarded up, and there was also a process where they destroyed the projects. What happened was a kind of hollowing out. This fueled the diaspora. Whereas syphilis for years had been confined to a specific socio-geographic region of Baltimore, within highly confined socio-sexual networks, the housing dislocation process served to move those people to other parts of the city. They took their syphilis and other behaviors with them. What is interesting about these explanations is that none of them are at all dramatic. The CDC thought the crack was the problem, but it wasn't as if crack came to Baltimore for the first time in 1995. It had been there for years. What they were saying is that there had been a subtle increase in the severity of the crack problem in the mid-1990s, and that that change had been enough to set off the syphilis epidemic. Zelman, likewise, wasn't saying that STD clinics in Baltimore were shut down. They were simply scaled back, the number of clinicians cut from 17 to 10. And nor was Potterat saying that all of Baltimore was hollowed out. All it took, he said, was the demolition of a handful of housing projects and the abandonment of homes in key downtown neighborhoods to send syphilis over the top. It takes only the smallest of changes to shatter an epidemic's equilibrium. The second, and perhaps more interesting, fact about these explanations is that all of them are describing a very different way of tipping an epidemic. The CDC is talking about the overall context for the disease, how the introduction and growth of an addictive drug can so change the environment of a city that it can cause a disease to tip. Zelman is talking about the disease itself. When the clinics were cut back, syphilis was given a second life. It had been an acute infection. It was now a chronic infection. It had become a lingering problem that stayed around for weeks. Potterat was focused on the people who were carrying syphilis. Syphilis, he was saying, was a disease carried by a certain kind of person in Baltimore, a very poor, probably drug-using, sexually active individual. If that kind of person was suddenly transported from their old neighborhood to a new one, the disease would have an opportunity to tip. There is more than one way to tip an epidemic, in other words. Epidemics are a function of the people who transmit infectious agents, the infectious agent itself, and the environment in which the infectious agent is operating. And when an epidemic tips, when it is jolted out of equilibrium, it tips because something has happened. Some change has occurred in one or two or three of those areas. These three agents of change I call the law of the few, the stickiness factor, and the power of context. The law of the few. When we say that a handful of East Village kids started the hush puppy epidemic, or that the scattering of the residents of a few housing projects was sufficient to start Baltimore's syphilis epidemic, what we are really saying is that in a given process or system, some people matter more than others. When it comes to epidemics, a tiny percentage of people do a huge amount of the work. Potterat, for example, once did an analysis of a gonorrhea epidemic in Colorado Springs. He looked at everyone who came to a public health clinic for treatment of gonorrhea over the space of 6 months. He found that about half of the cases came, essentially, from four neighborhoods, representing about 6% of the geographic area of the city. Half of that 6% figure, in turn, were socializing in the same six bars. Potterett then interviewed 768 people in that tiny subgroup and found that 600 of them either didn't give gonorrhea to anyone else or gave it to only one other person. Those people he called non-transmitters. The ones causing the epidemic to grow, the ones who were infecting 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 others with their diseases, were the remaining 168. In other words, in all of the city of Colorado Springs, a town of well in excess of 100,000 people, the epidemic of gonorrhea tipped because of the activities of about 168 people living in 4 small neighborhoods and frequenting the same 6 bars. Who were these 168 people? They are people who go out every night, people who have vastly more sexual partners than the norm, people whose lives and behavior are well outside of the ordinary. In the book And the Band Played On, Randy Schiltz discusses at length the so-called patient zero of AIDS, the French-Canadian flight attendant Gaetan Dugas, who claimed to have 2,500 sexual partners all over North America and who was linked to at least 40 of the earliest cases of AIDS in California and New York. This is the kind of person who makes epidemics of disease tip. Social epidemics work in exactly the same way. They are also driven by the efforts of a handful of exceptional people. In this case, it's not sexual appetites that set them apart. It's things like how sociable they are, or how energetic, or knowledgeable, or influential among their peers. The stickiness factor. We tend to spend a lot of time thinking about how to make messages more contagious, how to reach as many people as possible with our products or ideas. But the hard part of communication is often figuring out how to make sure a message makes an impact once it reaches its target. The hard part is making sure that what we have to say doesn't go in one ear and out the other. Stickiness means that a message makes an impact. It sticks in your memory. When Winston filtered tip cigarettes were introduced in the spring of 1954, the company came up with the slogan, "Winston tastes good like a cigarette should." That's a classically sticky advertising line. At the time, the ungrammatical and somehow provocative use of "like" instead of "as" created a minor sensation. It was the kind of phrase that people talked about, like the famous Wendy's tagline from 1984, "Where's the beef?" In his History of the Cigarette Industry, Richard Kluger writes that the marketers at R.J. Reynolds, which sells Winston, were delighted with the attention and made the offending slogan the lyric of a bouncy little jingle in television and radio, and Riley defended their syntax as a colloquialism rather than bad grammar. Within months of his introduction, on the strength of that catchy phrase, Winston tipped, racing past Parliament, Kent, and L&M into second place behind Viceroy in the American cigarette market. Within a few years, it was the best-selling brand in the country. To this day, if you say to most Americans, "Winston tastes good," they can finish the phrase like a cigarette should. Stickiness is a critical component in tipping. Unless you remember what I tell you, why would you ever change your behavior or buy my product or go and see my movie? The stickiness factor says there are specific ways of making a contagious message memorable. There are relatively simple changes in the presentation and structuring of information that can make a big difference in how sticky it is. The power of context. Every time someone in Baltimore comes to a public clinic for treatment of syphilis or gonorrhea, John Zettelman plugs his or her address into his computer so that the case shows up as a little black star on a map of the city. On Zettelman's map, the neighborhoods of East and West Baltimore, on either side of the downtown core, tend to be thick with black stars. From those two spots, the cases radiate outwards along the two central roadways that happen to cut through both neighborhoods. In the summer, when the incidence of sexually transmitted disease is highest, the clusters of black stars on the roads leading out of East and West Baltimore become thick with cases. The disease is on the move. But in the winter months, the map changes. When the weather turns cold, and the people of East and West Baltimore are much more likely to stay at home and not go to the bars and clubs and street corners where sexual transactions are made, the stars of each neighborhood fade away. The seasonal effect on the number of cases is so strong that it's not hard to imagine that a long, cold winter in Baltimore could be enough to substantially slow or lessen, at least for the season, the growth of the syphilis epidemic. Epidemics, Zettelman's map demonstrates, are strongly influenced by the situation, by the circumstances and conditions and particulars of the environments in which they operate. This much is obvious. What is interesting, though, is how far this principle can be extended. It isn't just prosaic factors like the weather that influence behavior. Even the smallest and subtlest and most unexpected factors can affect the way we act. One of the most infamous incidents in New York City history, for example, was the 1964 stabbing death of a young Queens woman by the name of Kitty Genovese. Genovese was chased by her assailant and attacked three times on the street over the course of half an hour as 38 of her neighbors watched from their windows. During that time, however, none of the 38 witnesses called the police. The case provoked rounds of self-recrimination. It became symbolic of the cold and dehumanizing effects of urban life. The truth about Genovese, however, turns out to be a little more complicated and more interesting. Two New York City psychologists, Bibb Latane and John Darley, subsequently conducted a series of studies to try and understand what they dubbed the bystander problem. They staged emergencies of one kind or another in different situations in order to see who would come and help. What they found, surprisingly, was that the one factor above all else that predicted helping behavior was how many witnesses there were to the event. In one experiment, for example, Latane and Darley had a student alone in a room stage an epileptic fit. When there was just one person next door, listening, that person rushed to the student's aid 85% of the time. But when subjects thought there were four others also overhearing the seizure, they came to the student's aid only 31% of the time. When people are in a group, in other words, responsibility for acting is diffused. They assume that someone else will make the call, or they assume that because no one else is acting, the apparent problem, the seizure-like sounds from the other room, isn't really a problem. In the case of Kitty Genovese, the lesson is not that no one called despite the fact that 38 heard her scream. It's that no one called because 38 people heard her scream. Ironically, had she been attacked in a lonely street with just one witness, she might have lived. The implications of this insight for understanding epidemics are considerable. Social epidemics tip when a large group of people are suddenly convinced to change in some way, to accept a new idea, buy a product, see a new movie. If behavior is influenced only by macro-environmental factors, by the alienation of urban life, for example, tipping an epidemic sounds like a tall order. The only way to make people care would be to move them to the country. But the Genovese case suggests that to get people to behave very differently, to get them to care about their neighbor in distress, for example, all we have to do is tinker with the smallest details of their immediate situation. We just need to make sure that they're the only ones in the room. The power of context says that human behavior is a lot more suggestible than it seems. These three rules of the tipping point, the law of the few, the stickiness factor, the power of context, offer a way of making sense of epidemics. They provide us with direction about how to go about reaching a tipping point. In the case of epidemics like hush puppies or syphilis in Baltimore, all of these factors probably played an important role. But that isn't always the case. There are times when by looking clearly at an epidemic through the prism of these three principles, we can learn how to separate those interventions that are worthwhile from those that are a waste of time and energy. The balance of this program will take these ideas and apply them to other puzzling situations and epidemics from the world around us. On the afternoon of April 18, 1775, a young boy who worked at a livery stable in Boston overheard one British Army officer say to another, "There'll be hell to pay tomorrow." The stable boy ran with the news to Boston's North End, to the home of a silversmith named Paul Revere. Revere listened gravely to the boy. That was not the first rumor to come his way that day. Earlier, he had been told of an unusual number of British officers gathered on Boston's Long Wharf, talking in low tones. British crewmen were spotted scurrying around the boats tethered beneath the HMS Somerset and the HMS Boyne in Boston Harbor. Several other sailors were seen on shore that morning, running what appeared to be last-minute errands. As the afternoon wore on, Revere and his close friend Joseph Warren became more and more convinced that the British were about to make the major move that had long been rumored, to march to the town of Lexington, northwest of Boston, to arrest the colonial leaders John Hancock and Samuel Adams, and then on to the town of Concord to seize the stores of guns and ammunition that some of the local colonial militia had stored there. What happened next has become part of historical legend. At 10 o'clock that night, Warren and Revere met. They decided they had to warn the communities surrounding Boston that the British were on their way, so that local militia could be roused to meet them. Revere was spirited across Boston Harbor to the ferry landing at Charleston. He jumped on a horse and began his midnight ride to Lexington. In 2 hours, he covered 13 miles. In every town he passed through along the way, he knocked on doors and spread the word, telling local colonial leaders of the oncoming British and telling them to spread the word to others. Church bells started ringing. Drums started beating. The news spread like a virus as those informed by Paul Revere sent out riders of their own until alarms were going off throughout the entire region. The word was in Andover, 40 miles due north of Boston by 5 a.m., and by 9 in the morning had reached as far away as Ashby, well to the northwest. When the British finally began their march towards Lexington on the morning of the 19th, their foray into the countryside was met, to their utter astonishment, with organized and fierce resistance. In Concord that day, the British were confronted and soundly beaten by the colonial militia, and from that exchange came the war known as the American Revolution. Paul Revere's midnight ride is perhaps the most famous historical example of a word-of-mouth epidemic. A piece of extraordinary news traveled a long distance in a very short time, mobilizing an entire region to arms. Not all word-of-mouth epidemics are this sensational, of course, but it's safe to say that word-of-mouth is, even in this age of mass communications and multi-million-dollar advertising campaigns, still the most important form of human communication. Think for a moment about the last expensive restaurant you ate at, the last expensive piece of clothing you bought, or the last movie you saw. In how many of those cases was your decision about where to spend your money heavily influenced by the recommendation of a friend? Word of mouth, however, remains very mysterious. People pass on all kinds of information to each other all the time, but it's only in the rare instance that such an exchange ignites a word-of-mouth epidemic. There is a small restaurant in my neighborhood that I love and that I've been telling my friends about for 6 months, but it's still half empty. My endorsement clearly isn't enough to start a word-of-mouth epidemic. Yet there are restaurants that, to my mind, aren't any better than the one in my neighborhood that open and within a matter of weeks are turning customers away. Why do some ideas and trends and messages tip and others don't? In the case of Paul Revere's ride, the answer to this seems easy. Revere was carrying a sensational piece of news. The British are coming. But if you look closely at the events of that evening, that explanation doesn't solve the riddle either. At the same time that Revere began his ride north and west of Boston, a fellow revolutionary, a tanner by the name of William Dawes, set out on the same urgent errand, working his way to Lexington via the town south of Boston. He was carrying the identical message through just as many towns, over just as many miles as Paul Revere. But Dawes's ride didn't set the countryside afire. The local militia leaders weren't alerted. If it were only the news itself that mattered in a word-of-mouth epidemic, Dawes would now be as famous as Paul Revere. He isn't. So why did Revere succeed where Dawes failed? The answer is that the success of any kind of social epidemic is heavily dependent on the involvement of people with a particular and rare set of social gifts. Revere's news tipped, and Dawes didn't, because of the differences between the two men. This is the law of the few. In this section, I'd like to talk about the people critical to social epidemics, about what makes someone like Paul Revere different from someone like William Dawes. These kinds of people are all around us, yet we often fail to give them proper credit for the role they play in our lives. I call them connectors, mavens, and salesmen. In the late 1960s, the psychologist Stanley Milgram conducted an experiment to find an answer to what has become known as the small world problem. The problem is this: how are human beings connected? Do we all belong to separate worlds, operating simultaneously but autonomously, so that the links between any two people anywhere in the world are few and distant? Or are we all bound up together in some grand interlocking web? In a way, Milgram was asking, how does an idea or trend or piece of news, the British are coming, travel through a population? Milgram's idea was to test this question with a chain letter. He got the names of 160 people who lived in Omaha, Nebraska, and mailed each of them a packet. In the packet was the name and address of a stockbroker who worked in Boston and lived in Sharon, Massachusetts. Each person was instructed to write his name on the packet and send it on to a friend or acquaintance that he thought would get the packet closer to the stockbroker. If you lived in Omaha and had a cousin outside of Boston, for example, you might send it to him on the grounds that even if he did not himself know the stockbroker, your cousin would be a lot more likely to be able to get to the stockbroker in 2 or 3 or 4 steps. The idea was that when the packet finally arrived at the stockbroker's house, Milgram could look at the list of all those whose hands it went through to get there and establish how closely connected someone chosen at random from one part of the country was to another person in another part of the country. Milgram found that most of the letters reached the stockbroker in 5 or 6 steps. This experiment is where we get the concept of 6 degrees of separation. In the 6 degrees of separation, not all degrees are equal. When Milgram analyzed his experiment, he found that many of the chains from Omaha to Sharon followed the same asymmetrical pattern. 24 letters reached the stockbroker at his home, in Sharon, and of those, 16 were given to him by the same person, a clothing merchant Milgram calls Mr. Jacobs. The balance of letters came to the stockbroker at his office, and of those, the majority came through 2 other men, who Milgram calls Mr. Brown and Mr. Jones. In all, half of the responses that came back to the stockbroker were delivered to him by these same 3 people. Think of it. Dozens of people, chosen at random from a large Midwestern city, send out letters independently. Some go through college acquaintances. Some send the letters to relatives. Some send them to old workmates. Everyone has a different strategy. Yet in the end, when all of those separate and idiosyncratic chains were completed, half of those letters ended up in the hands of Jacobs, Jones, and Brown. 6 degrees of separation doesn't mean that everyone is linked to everyone else in just 6 steps. It means that a very small number of people are linked to everyone else in a few steps, and the rest of us are linked to the world through those special few. There is an easy way to explore this idea. Suppose that you made a list of the 40 people whom you would call your circle of friends, not including family and coworkers, and in each case, worked backward until you could identify the person who is ultimately responsible for setting in motion the series of connections that led to that friendship. My oldest friend Bruce, for example, I met in first grade, so I'm the responsible party. That's easy. I met my friend Nigel because he lived down the hall in college from my friend Tom, who I met because in freshman year he invited me to play touch football. Tom is responsible for Nigel. Once you've made all of the connections, the strange thing is that you'll find the same names coming up again and again. I have a friend named Amy, who I met when her friend Katie brought her to a restaurant one night where I was having dinner. I know Katie because she's best friends with my friend Larissa, who I know because I was told to look her up by a mutual friend of both of ours, Mike A., whom I know because he went to school with another friend of mine, Mike H., who used to work at a political weekly with my friend Jacob. No Jacob, no Amy. In fact, when I go down my list of 40 friends, 30 of them, in one way or another, lead back to Jacob. My social circle is, in reality, not a circle. It's a pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid is a single person, Jacob, who is responsible for an overwhelming majority of the relationships that comprise my life. Not only is my social circle not a circle then, but it's not mine either. It belongs to Jacob. It's more like a club than he invited me to join. These people who link us up with the world, who bridge Omaha and Sharon, who introduce us to our social circle, these people on whom we rely more heavily than we realize are connectors, people with a special gift for bringing the world together. What makes someone a connector? The first and most obvious criterion is that connectors know lots of people. They are the kinds of people who know everyone. All of us know someone like this, but I don't think we spend a lot of time thinking about the importance of these kinds of people. I'm not even sure that most of us really believe that the kind of person who knows everyone really knows everyone, but they do. Connectors are important for more than simply the number of people they know. Their importance is also a function of the kinds of people they know. Perhaps the best way to understand this point is through the popular parlor game 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. The idea behind the game is to try to link any actor or actress through the movies they've been in to the actor Kevin Bacon in less than 6 steps. So, for example, O.J. Simpson was in Naked Gun with Priscilla Presley, who was in Ford Fairlane with Gilbert Gottfried, who was in Beverly Hills Cop 2 with Paul Reiser, who was in Diner with Kevin Bacon. That's 4 steps. Bacon, although a fairly young actor, has already been in so many movies with so many different people that there is almost no one to whom he cannot be easily connected. Recently, a computer scientist at the University of Virginia by the name of Brett Tayden actually sat down and figured out what the average Bacon number is for the quarter million or so actors and actresses who have played in television films or major motion pictures, and came up with 2.8312 steps. Anyone who has ever acted, in other words, can be linked to Bacon in an average of under 3 steps. That sounds impressive, except that Tayden then went back and performed an even more heroic calculation, figuring out what the average degree of connectedness was for everyone who had ever acted in Hollywood. For example, how many steps on average does it take to link everyone in Hollywood to Robert De Niro, or Shirley Temple, or Adam Sandler, and so on? What Tayden found was that when he listed all Hollywood actors in order of their connectedness, Bacon only ranked 669th. Martin Sheen, by contrast, can be connected on average to every actor in 2.63681 steps, which puts him almost 650 places higher than Bacon. The best connected actor of all time? Rod Steiger. There are lots of people, however, who have made lots of movies and aren't particularly well connected. John Wayne made 179 movies in his 60-year career and still ranks only 116th. What really sets someone like Steiger apart is his range. More than half of John Wayne's movies were westerns, meaning that he made the same kind of movie with the same kind of actors over and over again. But someone like Steiger, he's made great movies like the Oscar-winning On the Waterfront and dreadful movies like Carpool. He won an Oscar for his role in The Heat of the Night and also made B-movies so bad they went straight to video. He's been in 38 dramas, 12 crime pictures and comedies, 11 thrillers, 8 action films, 7 westerns, 6 war movies, 4 documentaries, 3 horror flicks, 2 sci-fi films and a musical, among others. Rod Steiger is one of those actors who has acted with everyone because he's managed to move up and down and back and forth among all the different worlds and subcultures and niches and levels that the acting profession has to offer. This is what connectors are like. They are the Rod Steigers of everyday life. They are people who all of us can reach in only a few steps because, for one reason or another, they manage to occupy many different worlds and subcultures and niches. In the case of connectors, their ability to span many different worlds is a function of something intrinsic to their personality, some combination of curiosity, self-confidence, sociability, and energy. And they also have this thing, whatever it is, that brings people together. There is a very good example of the way connectors function in the work of the sociologist Mark Granovetter. In his classic 1974 study, Getting a Job, Granovetter looked at several hundred professional and technical workers from the Boston suburb of Newton, interviewing them in some detail on their employment history. He found that 56% of those he talked to found their job through a personal connection. 18.8% used formal means, advertisements, headhunters. Another roughly 20% applied directly. This much is not surprising. The best way to get in the door is through a personal connection. But curiously, Granovetter found that of these personal connections, the majority were weak ties. Of those who used a contact to find a job, only 16% saw that contact often, as they would if the contact were a good friend. 55.6% saw their contact only occasionally, and 28% saw the contact rarely. People weren't getting their jobs through their friends. They were getting them through their acquaintances. Why is this? Granovetter argues that it is because when it comes to finding out about new jobs, or for that matter, new information or new ideas, weak ties are always more important than strong ties. Your friends, after all, occupy the same world that you do. They might work with you or live near you and go to the same churches, schools, and parties. How much, then, would they know that you wouldn't know? Your acquaintances, on the other hand, by definition occupy a very different world than you. They're much more likely to know something that you don't. To capture this apparent paradox, Granovetter coined the marvelous phrase, the strength of weak ties. Acquaintances, in short, represent a source of social power, and the more acquaintances you have, the more powerful you are. We rely on connectors to give us access to opportunities and worlds to which we don't belong. This principle holds for more than just jobs. It holds for restaurants, movies, fashion trends, or anything else that moves by word of mouth. The closer an idea or a product comes to a connector, the more power and opportunity it has. Could this be one of the reasons hush puppies suddenly became a major fashion trend? Along the way from the East Village to Middle America, a connector, or a series of connectors, must have suddenly become enamored of them. And through their enormous social connections, their long lists of weak ties, their role in multiple worlds and subcultures, they must have been able to take that idea and send it to 1,000 directions at once, to make it really tip. Hush Puppies, in a sense, got lucky. And perhaps one of the reasons why so many fashion trends don't make it into mainstream America is that simply by sheer bad fortune, they never happen to meet the approval of a connector along the way. Here, then, is the explanation for why Paul Revere's Midnight Ride started a word-of-mouth epidemic, and William Dawes's did not. Paul Revere was a connector. He was gregarious and intensely social. When he died, his funeral was attended, in the words of one contemporary newspaper account, by troops of people. He was a member of several select social clubs. It is not surprising, then, that when the British Army began its secret campaign in 1774 to root out and destroy the stores of arms and ammunition held by the fledgling revolutionary movement, that Revere became a kind of unofficial clearinghouse for the anti-British forces. He knew everybody. It would be a mistake, however, to think that connectors are the only people who matter in a social epidemic. At some point in the rise of Hush Puppies, the shoes were discovered by connectors, who broadcast the idea of Hush Puppies as cool far and wide. But who told the connectors about Hush Puppies? It's possible that connectors learn about new information by an entirely random process, that because they know so many people, they get access to new things wherever they pop up. If you look closely at social epidemics, however, it becomes clear that just as there are people we rely on to connect us to other people, there are also people we rely on to connect us with new information. There are, in other words, information specialists and people specialists. Sometimes, of course, these two specialties are one and the same. Part of the particular power of Paul Revere was that he wasn't just a networker. He wasn't just the man with the biggest Rolodex in colonial Boston. He was also actively engaged in gathering information about the British. In the fall of 1774, he set up a secret group that met regularly at the Green Dragon Tavern, whose express purpose was to monitor British troop movements. He helped find out the intelligence, and he passed it on. Paul Revere was a connector, but he was also, and this is the second of the three kinds of people who control word-of-mouth epidemics, a maven. The word maven means one who accumulates knowledge. Perhaps the most complete understanding of what it means to be a maven comes from economists who have taken the term in recent years and applied it to a certain kind of marketplace behavior. For example, when a grocery store wants to sell a given product, they put it on sale. They put an arrow next to it on the aisle and lower the price. But occasionally they make a mistake and forget to lower the price. What people who study supermarkets have found, though, is that in that case, the product still sells as much as if its price really had been lowered. This is, when you think about it, a potentially disturbing piece of information. The whole premise behind sales, or supermarket specials, is that we as consumers are very aware of the prices of things and will react accordingly. We buy more in response to lower prices and less in response to higher prices. But if all we're reacting to is the label on sale and not the price, then what's to stop supermarkets from never lowering their prices? What's to stop them from cheating us with phony on-special signs every time we walk in? The answer is that although most of us don't look at prices, every retailer knows that a very small number of people do. And if they find something amiss, price that's too high, they'll do something about it. If a store tried to pull the sales stunt too often, these are the people who would figure it out and complain to management or the Better Business Bureau and tell their friends and acquaintances to avoid the store. These are the people who keep the marketplace honest. In the 10 years or so since this group was first identified, economists have gone to great lengths to understand them. They have found them in every walk of life and in every socioeconomic group. One name for them is price vigilantes. The other, more common name for them, is market mavens. A maven is a person who has information on a lot of different products or prices or places. They like to be helpers in the marketplace. They take you shopping. They go shopping for you. They distribute about 4 times as many coupons as other people. They're more than experts. An expert will talk about cars because they love cars, but they don't talk about cars because they love you and want to help you with your decision. The market maven will. They are more socially motivated. Mavens know things that the rest of us don't. They read more magazines than the rest of us, more newspapers, and they may be the only people who really read junk mail. Mavens have the knowledge and the social skills to start word-of-mouth epidemics. What sets mavens apart, though, is not so much what they know, but how they pass it along. Mavens want to help, for no other reason than because they like to help, and that turns out to be an awfully effective way of getting someone's attention. This is also surely part of the explanation for why Paul Revere's message was so powerful on the night of his midnight ride. News of the British March did not come by fax or by means of a group email. It wasn't broadcast on the nightly news, surrounded by commercials. It was carried by a man, a volunteer, riding on a cold night with no personal agenda other than a concern for the liberty of his peers. With hush puppies as well, perhaps the shoes caught the attention of connectors precisely because they weren't part of any self-conscious commercial fashion trend. Maybe a fashion maven went to the East Village looking for new ideas and found out that you could get these really cool old hush puppies at a certain thrift store for a very good price, and told his friends, who bought the shoes for themselves because there was something about the personal, disinterested, expert opinion of a maven that makes us all sit up and listen. The one thing that a maven is not is a persuader. He's not the kind of person who wants to twist your arm. Mavens are really information brokers, sharing and trading what they know. For a social epidemic to start, though, a good number of people are actually going to have to be persuaded to do something. A good number of the young people who bought hush puppies were people who once upon a time wouldn't have been caught dead in them. In a social epidemic, mavens are databanks. They provide the message. Connectors are social glue. They spread it. But there is also a select group of people, salesmen, with the skills to persuade us when we are unconvinced of what we're hearing. And they are as critical to the tipping of word-of-mouth epidemics as the other two groups. Who are these salesmen, and what makes them so good at what they do? The question of what makes someone or something persuasive is a lot less straightforward than it seems. We know it when we see it, but just what it is not always obvious. What happens when two people talk? That's really the basic question here, because that's the basic context in which all persuasion takes place. We know that people talk back and forth. They listen, they interrupt, they move their hands. The pioneer of the study of this process, what's called cultural microrhythms, is a man named William Condon. In one of his most famous research projects in the 1960s, he attempted to decode a 4.5-second segment of film in which a woman says to a man and child over dinner, "You should come around here every night. We never had a dinner time like this in months." Condon broke the film into individual frames, each representing about 1/45th of a second. Then he watched and watched. He spent a year and a half on that short segment of film until, finally, in his peripheral vision, he saw what he had always sensed was there. The wife was turning her head exactly as the husband's hands came up. From there, he picked up other micro-movements, other patterns that occurred over and over again, until he recognized that in addition to talking and listening, the three people around the table were also engaging in what he called interactional synchrony. Their conversation had a rhythmic physical dimension. Each person would, within the space of 1/2 or 3/45ths of a second, move a shoulder or cheek or an eyebrow or a hand, sustain that movement, stop it, change direction, and start again. And what's more, those movements were perfectly in time to each person's own words, emphasizing and underlining and elaborating on the process of articulation, so that the speaker was, in effect, dancing to his or her own speech. At the same time, the other people around the table were dancing along as well, moving their faces and shoulders and hands and bodies to the same rhythm. It's not that everyone was moving the same way, any more than people dancing to a song all dance the same way. It's that the timing of stops and starts of each person's micro movements, the jumps and shifts of body and face, were perfectly in harmony. Subsequent research has revealed that it isn't just gesture that's harmonized, but also conversational rhythm. When two people talk, their volume and pitch fall into balance. What linguists call speech rate, the number of speech sounds per second, equalizes. So does what is known as latency, the period of time that lapses between the moment one speaker stops talking and the moment the other speaker begins. Two people may arrive at a conversation with very different conversational patterns, but almost instantly they reach a common ground. Like all specialized human traits, some people have much more mastery over this reflex than others. Part of what it means to have a powerful or persuasive personality, then, is that you can draw others into your own rhythms and dictate the terms of the interaction. Skilled musicians know this, and good speakers, says Joseph Capella, who teaches at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. They know when the crowds are with them, literally in synchrony with them, in movements and nods and stillness and moments of attention. The essence of the salesman is that, when it comes to conversation, their rhythms cannot be resisted. In the late 1960s, a television producer named Joan Ganz Cooney set out to start an epidemic. Her target was 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds. Her agent of infection was television, and the virus she wanted to spread was literacy. The show would last an hour and run every day of the week, but the hope was that if that hour was contagious enough, it could serve as an educational tipping point, giving children from disadvantaged homes a leg up once they began elementary school, spreading pro-learning values from watchers to non-watchers, infecting children and their parents, and lingering long enough to have impact well after the children stopped watching the show. Cooney probably wouldn't have used these concepts or described her goals in precisely this way. But what she wanted to do, in essence, was create a learning epidemic to counter the prevailing epidemics of poverty and illiteracy. She called her idea Sesame Street. By any measure, this was an audacious idea. Television is a great way to reach lots of people, very easily and cheaply. But it isn't a particularly educational medium. Jerry Lesser, a Harvard University psychologist who joined Cooney in founding Sesame Street, says that when he was first asked to join the project back in the late 1960s, he was skeptical. "I had always been very much into fitting how you teach to what you know about the child," he says. "You try to find the kid's strengths so you can play to them. You try to understand the kid's weaknesses so you can avoid them. Then you try to teach that individual kid's profile. Television has no potential, no power to do that," he said. "Good teaching is interactive. It engages the child individually. But a television is just a talking box. In experiments, children who are asked to read a passage and then tested on it will invariably score higher than children asked to watch a video of the same subject matter. The word that educational experts use to describe television is low involvement." Cooney and Lesser enlisted some of the top creative minds of the period. They borrowed techniques from television commercials to teach children about numbers. They used the live animation of Saturday morning cartoons to teach lessons about learning the alphabet. They brought in celebrities to sing and dance and star in comedy sketches that taught children about the virtues of cooperation or about their own emotions. Sesame Street aimed higher and tried harder than any other children's show had, and the extraordinary thing was that it worked. Virtually every time the show's educational value has been tested, it has been proven to improve the reading and learning skills of its viewers. There are few educators and child psychologists who don't believe that the show managed to spread its infectious message well beyond the homes of those who watched it. The creators of Sesame Street accomplished something extraordinary, and the story of how they did that is a marvelous illustration of the second of the rules of the tipping point, the stickiness factor. They discovered that by making small but critical adjustments in how they presented ideas to preschoolers, they could overcome television's weakness as a teaching tool and make what they had to say memorable. Sesame Street succeeded because it learned how to make television sticky. As I previously discussed, the law of the few says that one critical factor in epidemics is the nature of the messenger. A pair of shoes or a warning or an infection or a new movie can become highly contagious and tip simply by being associated with a particular kind of person. But in all those examples, I took it as a given that the message itself was something that could be passed on. Paul Revere started a word-of-mouth epidemic with the phrase, "The British are coming." If he had instead gone on that midnight ride to tell people he was having a sale on the pewter mugs at his silversmith shop, even he, with all his enormous personal gifts, could not have galvanized the Massachusetts